British public seemed to want more, maybe even Johnson's resignation. But some analysts ask, how is that the holding of an illegal Christmas party will cause more outrage from the British public than their government's support for killing civilians in places like Yemen and Palestine? Is there a problem here with the overall moral compass? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on The Spotlight.
Back-to-back scandals are taking their toll on the popularity of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his ruling Conservative Party. An opinion poll shows support for Conservatives is down 4 points to 32%. That gives the opposition Labour Party a 9-point lead, their largest since 2014. Johnson's own ratings are also at their lowest since his party won a landslide in 2019. His popularity is 14% down in 2 weeks. A video was leaked this week showing Downing Street staffers joking about a Christmas party held there last December, while the country was under COVID lockdown. The scandal has already led to the resignation of Johnson's spokeswoman, Allegra Stratton.
My remarks seemed to make light of the rules. Rules that people were doing everything to obey. That was never my intention. I will regret those remarks for the rest of my days, and I offer my profound apologies to all of you at home for them.
The British Prime Minister has denied that there was a party and apologised for the video.
I apologise for the impression that has been given that staff in Downing Street take this less than seriously. I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
While the leaked video was the talk of town, reports came out about 2 more lockdown gatherings at the Downing Street, including one at Johnson's own flat. A probe is now underway into whether the parties broke COVID rules. The Premier is facing calls to step down.
Downing Street willfully broke the rules and mocked the sacrifices we have all made, shattering the public's trust. The Prime Minister has a duty, the only right and moral choice left to him. It is for his resignation.
Yeah. Labour leader Keir Starmer is strongly critical of Johnson too.
But there's also this basic question of trust, and that is broken with the Prime Minister, okay. And that's why he is unfit for office.
In recent months, the British Prime Minister has faced criticism over other issues, including his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. That's beside revelations Johnson intervened to evacuate pets from Kabul during the chaotic Afghan withdrawal in August. Now the latest scandal involving the lockdown parties may be the final nail in the coffin as Johnson's popularity continues to plummet. More than half of those taking part in the latest opinion poll believe that the Premier should step down.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the Spotlight. Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist out of Bristol, and Fra Hughes, journalist and political analyst out of Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Oh, I'll welcome both of you to the program. Let's start this off in Bristol. And Tony, your take on the overall reaction of the British public and dealing with this Christmas party scandal.
Well, look, Marcia, it's gone from hero to zero, hasn't he? The man who could get Brexit done, and now he's plummeting in the polls. But there's two important aspects to this that haven't really been covered, I don't think, anywhere near enough. One of them is, if Boris Johnson is to go, who is going to replace him? And I think we always got to look at the man standing in the shadows behind the curtain. And that would almost certainly be Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, who is very much a creature of the City of London. He's a former employee of some of the big financial institutions. And that would, of course, put them in the driving seat rather than the Conservative Party as a whole. So, you know, we need to look carefully at, you know, maybe what's going on here. If Boris is going to be moved out of the way, who is going to be taking his place? Very important, and people often forget that. It's very easy to throw mud at whoever's in power, and what we often forget is that actually maybe they are just put there in power by some more powerful forces behind the scenes. I think that's mostly the case in Western politics anyway. The other thing is that this seems to have all happened because Boris has instituted this thing called Plan B a fortnight or so ago, and there's been increasing calls from all sides for him to go because of this. Now, this is as a massive overreaction, in my view, to the Omicron variant. Now, you know, some have called this Omicron variant a gift from God, because what it does is it enables people to become immune after catching it, and it's very unlikely that anyone will die of it. It's a very mild version of the disease. So rather than embracing this, this has been jumped on as a terrible, terrible thing. And I think there's many people on all sides of the political spectrum, and particularly in the press, who feel that what Johnson's done by overreacting to this and following along with some of the alarmist speculation about the tens of thousands of deaths and hospitalizations that may result from something which the South Africans tell us is very mild is also related to this. So, I mean, I think it's clear that the press is leading this. And also, I think, whereabouts have these leaks come from, these leaks about the party? Let's look at the facts. So the party that Boris Johnson is alleged to have presided over, he wasn't at that party, and he took no part in it. So it's quite feasible that it was arranged by somebody who was at Downing Street, like his chief of staff, etc., behind his back. And I think that's not impossible, although, of course, he may well have known about it, and certainly the police, who would guard 10 Downing Street, would certainly have known about it. So it's very strange that they didn't act at the time. There are actually a lot of prosecutions going through in Britain still, right now, of ordinary people like you and I that were caught having apparently illegal parties at this time of year. Why not the top people? So the police have got a lot of questions to answer too on that occasion. So okay. I think, you know, what I'm trying to do, Marcia, is trying to get behind this, because I'm a little bit concerned when I see the press all going at the same time. And I'm also always very, very aware of, if Boris is moved out of the way, who's going to take over and what influences do they represent?
Okay. All right. Well, let me get in on this conversation. I mean, many say that the public's upset because they feel that Johnson lied. At least, as Tony says, that's exactly what's being talked about in the press. But, I mean, it wasn't like he was known to be an honest person before he was elected as Prime Minister, from his extramarital affairs to so many other situations, whether we're talking about Brexit or other lies that he has been known to tell. So, I mean, what is it that all of a sudden, as Tony has said, I mean, there seems to be an unbelievable reaction when you didn't elect an honest person to begin with. I mean, why such an uproar? They're thinking that maybe he lied now. I mean, what is this really about, in your perspective?
Well, I would have to say it's possible that there's some form of a political coup going on in the background. If you remember that this actual accusation about the party in Downing Street was nearly 12 months ago, so obviously this evidence, this videotape, this recording has been in someone's hands for 12 months before it's been put out into the public domain. So it's possible there's a political coup in the background orchestrated by other members of the Conservative Party, indeed maybe front bench members of the Conservative Party who want to oust Johnson in favour of a new leader. That said, it was only in 2019 that Boris Johnson was denying accusations that he burnt a £50 note in front of a homeless person when he was a student many years ago in London. I think we should bear in mind that there have been scandals all the way through his premiership. We had the Dominic Cummings affair, and then we had Neil Ferguson resign, a senior analyst with the government. Boris Johnson has a track record of being a bit of a bluffer and a blagger, and he's someone who talked himself into power and talks himself out of trouble. I don't think Johnson will actually go anywhere. There's an 80-seat majority for the Conservative Party within the British Parliament. He's probably in a stronger position than any party political leader has been in decades. And I think it's very important for Boris Johnson that having such a large majority in the House, and there is no election planned before May 2024, I think he will just ride this out the same way he has done with every other political scandal in his career to date.
But Tony, Labour leader there is saying it's a problem, basic question of trust. And again, I mean, we look at this and it's almost comical, I guess, unfortunately, when we hear politicians talk about trust, but especially, again, Boris Johnson and his given record. It just seems, as you already mentioned, there seems to be political maneuvering out of this, that someone is trying to get to something else, of course, with the cover of this Christmas party. I mean, as you said, you're a journalist, so especially journalists know that when the mainstream media makes a big deal out of something, you better look behind it and see exactly what's going on. So you talked about some of the possibilities of the political maneuvering taking place here. Where do you see this going exactly? Do you think, opposite from our guests in Belfast, that it could actually cause the fall of Johnson or not?
Well, yes. I mean, I think I do, because, first of all, I'll say it was just over a year ago, all these so-called parties, etc., and now the things we've seen as evidence parties, happened about a year ago. But it was just before that, the resignation of Dominic Cummings behind the scenes. Now, he was the chief of staff at Downing Street, and he's a very Machiavellian character. He brags about reading Sun Tzu's Art of War and The Prince by Machiavelli. These kind of it doesn't seem as if he was in there to do a good job for the public. He was there to do political manoeuvring. It may well be him that's spearheaded the release of these various leaks at this particular time. And this is one of the things that happens, I think, I'm afraid, in journalism too, is that journalists and editors will hang on to stuff for a long time in order to use it to threaten and eventually maybe use it to manoeuvre out a specific individual, in this case Boris Johnson. Now, there's another aspect to this, and that is there's something in the Conservative Party called the 1922 Committee, and this is a big, powerful committee of backbenchers, people who are not involved in the government. In other words, they're not on Boris's payroll. But what they can do is they can order a vote of the membership of the parliamentary party and of the whole Conservative Party of confidence in Boris. So even though Boris has got a big majority in the Houses of Parliament, it may be his own party can unseat him and replace him, even though he's in that position. So that is entirely possible. But I think it's also fascinating and very important. You mentioned yourself the killing of civilians in Yemen and places like this, because, of course, all this gets drowned out in the distraction of what's going on at Westminster, which is effectively it's internal Conservative Party manoeuvrings, I think, that's going on. And it's not helped by the fact that the Labour Party is, in fact, on Tuesday this coming week, the Labour Party is due to vote with Boris, supporting Boris, in the stricter COVID measures he's trying to bring in, whereas many of his own party are revolting against him. Well, what this means is that the Labour Party, the opposition party in Britain, could potentially bring down the government voting against it and embarrass it, but it's choosing to vote with Boris instead. So there's a 40, 50, 60 backbenchers conservatives about to vote against Boris Johnson, and Labour could have voted with them and made it very, very difficult for Boris to continue and to have any credibility they have chosen. So what I'm saying is the real opposition politically in the Houses of Parliament, in the House of Commons today, is the Conservative Party. And that is an extraordinary position to be in the country. So distraction away from these wars abroad, I think you're absolutely right to point that out. This is still carrying on with British military facilities being moved over to Saudi Arabia to aid this bombing of Yemen, etc., which is continuing to this day. I think that these are the sorts of issues that get drowned out. What I'd like to see is I'd like to see some real, genuine leadership in the country, and also some genuine attitudes from the press in right across the Western world in calling out some of this horrifically amoral, immoral, attempts to manoeuvre, particularly in the Middle East. And of course, we've had the appalling news about the injustices to Julian Assange, which Boris Johnson himself doesn't seem to have mentioned once, even though it's one of the most important court cases ever to take place on the planet, which is taking place right now in London. Right. Boris has nothing to say about that, and that's another reason why he's losing support fast.
Okay, well, turning back to Belfast, I mean, your perspective, and Tony just mentioned, for example, Assange, and I want to look at that situation that we don't see that type of outrage one would think would see coming out of the British public. And again, I go back to London's support for repressive regimes, whether we're talking about Israel or Saudi Arabia, or we're talking about Bahrain, that they're giving these weapons to these repressive regimes and supporting them in so many different ways. And yet nothing is said. Is it because the British public, the public is not informed? Is it that they don't care? Or is it the role of the media? How do you assess this overall?
Well, I think what you've asked is a very, very, very interesting question. If we stick with Julian for just one second, his exposure of the Afghan warlog, by warlogs, was what brought him to the attention and WikiLeaks of the world public. He exposed war crimes carried out by America, done in the name of the American people, part of the propaganda war that's preceded nearly everything that's happened with these humanitarian interventions throughout the world on behalf of Britain, NATO, America, mainly at the behest and in favour of strengthening Israel's position within the region by attacking strong anti-Zionist governments that stand with and beside the Palestinian people. So Julian is suffering from the revenge of the American administration for him showing the world what America is doing in the name of democracy and these humanitarian interventions. I think that Britain is completely complicit in the war crimes that are carried out within West Asia and the Middle East. I don't think that some people who claim Britain are the lapdogs of America and have somehow, you know, bowed down to American demands to have Julian Assange extradited. I think Keir Starmer, who was involved in the original prosecution, I believe Boris Johnson and the whole British establishment are more than happy to see Julian Assange face 175 years in the darkest, deepest hole that they can find in the American penal system. So Britain is complicit and has always been complicit in its own colonial history and in its present bombing of Yemen, probably secret attacks in Syria, the destruction of Libya. They are all birds of a feather, these neoliberal, colonial, quasi-imperialist, capitalist governments that are there to demonize and to extract resources from the southern hemisphere to come to the northern hemisphere. And I believe that the reason, it's quite possible that a lot of this is just pure distraction from the debacle of Brexit, from Julian's extradition, from everything that else is happening. It could be smoke and mirrors. Look over here as a distraction while we continue to bomb, maim, and terrorize people throughout the globe.
Well, Tony, it just seems that there is a lack of any type of moral compass in British politics. It just seems that it's money, it's economics over morality. I mean, your perspective on that and the effect of that type of mentality and those who are ruling the country, the effect that it has overall.
Well, look, I want to reassure you, Marcia, it's actually not all over British politics. There is actually a very important faction in both of the main political parties, which does have a moral compass. It's just that the way the system works is that the Prime Minister will recruit yes men, and I would say actually what he's dealing with is a dwindling supply of them, into the cabinet. I mean, for example, we've got, you know, a Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who was involved in all these secret meetings with the Israeli government, and yet she was invited back in, even though she broke the ministerial code when she was International Development Secretary. She was presiding over a massive assault against a vigil in the city, in the centre of London, on Clapham Common, and yet she suffered no penalty because of that. I think Boris Johnson is paying the price of sticking with this small coterie of amoral Conservative MPs who he's managed to recruit into the cabinet. But there is, as I said, quite a force out there within the backbenchers in the Parliamentary Conservative Party who are getting increasing. They're looking at the numbers. The numbers of MPs who are pro-Boris and anti-Boris, and also the numbers of members of the Conservative Party, and they're realising they're getting to the point where maybe they can just unseat Boris and replace him with somebody else. And quite who that, I mean, that, like I said, it may be Rishi Sunak. But I think we also need to look, when we're looking at the perspective of all these sometimes incomprehensible wars that are going on in the Middle East, the British and the Americans particularly have been supporting, that there is a long-term plan. First, during the Second World War, to institute the State of Israel, and secondly, to create a war in order to discredit all the three main monotheistic faiths. And this, I think, has been ongoing for a long time, and many people haven't actually seen that this is an attempt to actually... I mean, people say, like my own family, I talk to them and they say, well, no one wants a war. Well, actually, some people do. For these sort of spiritual and ideological reasons, they want to have a war to discredit these faiths, and they also want to have that war to make a lot of money. And so the only forces we've got are within the House of Commons, the people who are not in the key positions in Keir Starmer or Boris Johnson's cabinets, you know, the shadow cabinet Starmer's got. Those are the people, I think, that may make a difference here.
Okay.
And it's very important that we keep a very close eye on what these backbenchers are up to, because they will decide Boris's fate.
All right. And for 1 minute, where do you see all of this going in and affecting British politics? Your assessment overall?
Well, I think there was a very interesting poll that came out recently, a YouGov poll on how politicians act in power and why they are there. 5% of the respondents said that politicians were there to work on behalf of the public, and 63% of the respondents said the politicians were there to promote themselves. So what we have are millionaires and billionaires in an elite clique within the political structures that govern the country, and people like ourselves see them for what they are. They are people who are self-promoters and are using politics in order to line their own pockets.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Out of Bristol, historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling, and out of Belfast, Frau Hughes, journalist and political analyst. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. Make sure you join us right here next time. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
الذي له ملك السماوات والأرض ولم يتخذ ولدا
He to whom belongs the dominion of the heavens and the earth, and who has not taken a son, and has not had a partner in dominion, and has created each thing and determined it with precise determination.
The second verse of chapter Furqan states, الَّذِي لَهُ مُلْكُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ He to whom belongs the dominion of the heavens and the earth, وَلَمْ يَتَّخِذْ وَلَدًا And he has not taken any son unto himself, وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُ شَرِيكٌ فِي الْمُلْكِ Nor has he any partner in his dominion, وَخَلَقَ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ فَقَدَّرَهُ تَقْدِيرًا He created everything, then he ordered them in due proportions. This verse, dear listeners, the second verse of chapter Furqan, is talking about describing the Almighty Allah who has descended the Furqan with four attributes, one of which is in fact the base and the rest are its results and branches. We know that polytheists, Jews and Christians, each believed in a way that Allah has got a partner or a kind of child. And this is the Holy Quran in the second verse rejecting these false beliefs. These beliefs have been rejected many times throughout the verses of the Holy Quran, but now this verse is describing Allah with four attributes. First, it says, He to whom belongs the dominion of the heavens and the earth. So, He is the ruler of all universe, the skies and the earth, and nothing is out of his sovereignty. With regard to the Quranic word lahu, has come before the phrase mulku samawat, and according to Arabic literature, it is a reason for limitation and exclusivity. So, when we say lahu mulku samawat wal ard, it means that it is only him who is the owner of the heavens and the earth. It is understood that the real domination and authority of the skies and the earth belongs to him, subhanahu wa ta'ala. For his rulership is general, perpetual and real. Contrary to other rulerships that are unstable, they are insignificant. And in the meantime, they are dependent on him, subhanahu wa ta'ala. But this is real ownership. This is real domination and authority. لَهُ مُلْكُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ. It could have said مُلْكُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ لَهُ, but in this way there would be no limitation and exclusivity in the ownership of the Almighty Allah.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Then the polytheist beliefs are one by one rejected. الَّذِي لَهُ مُلْكُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَلَمْ يَتَّخِذْ وَلَدًا. He has not taken any son. Basically, needing child, as we said before, is whether for using his or her physical power, or it might be for having him or her at the time of loneliness. Of course, none of these attributes, none of these needs are part of his pure essence. In this way, the Christians belief and the fact that they believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and the belief of the Jews that Almighty Allah has son, they are both rejected. And moreover, our polytheist belief in this regard is rejected. Then the verse continues saying, nor has he any partner in his dominion. وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُ شَرِيكٌ فِي الْمُلْكِ. Our polytheist believed in partner or partners, which they considered as partner of Almighty Allah. When they wanted to worship, they turned to them for the sake of intercession, and they asked their help for fulfilling their needs, so that they explicitly uttered ugly and polytheistic words and sentences when they wanted to somehow return to Allah or say Labbaik at the time of the rites of Hajj. They said, I accepted your call, O Lord, who has no partner except the partner that belongs to you. And you are the owner of this partner, and you are the owner of what he owns. The Holy Quran rejects all these vain imaginations, and in the last sentence implies that not only Allah has created all things, but also He has precisely defined their proportions and administrations. We'll talk about this verse more, God willing, in the next program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puriza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The death of India's Chief of Defence Staff, Bipin Rawat, his wife and 11 others in a chopper crash on Wednesday made big news across the subcontinent. The report went viral on social media and received huge attention region-wide. Following the incident, a female staffer at one of the Kashmir's leading banks received suspension for what they described as, quote, inappropriate reaction to a social media post about the death of the chief of defense staff, unquote. People in Kashmir are criticizing the suspension, saying this is a violation of their rights to free speech.
I am not judging her reaction, but emoji symbols are sometimes sent by mistake, since touch screens are highly sensitive. This is highly undemocratic on the part of Kashmir officials.
In the Indian-administered Kashmir, government offices and semi-government institutions have issued circulars and updated codes of conduct cautioning employees against posting anything critical of India or its rule in the region. Scores of people in Kashmir have removed their social media posts out of fear of police action. A police officer who didn't want his name to be disclosed said that only posts that can attract a lot of attention or encourage disruption of public order are being assessed, since Kashmir is a sensitive region. However, analysts say authorities in Kashmir are trying to control the narrative to justify India's decision to end Kashmir's special status in August 2019.
This is depiction or reflection of sense of insecurity which has overtaken Indian state, because they feel if they allow people to express freely, the reality of Kashmir will get exposed before whole of the world.
India is increasingly using its anti-terror laws since the Hindu nationalist party Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in 2014. In Kashmir alone, over 2,300 people have been booked under the law since 2019, and half of them are still in prison. Global human rights bodies, including the United Nations, slammed India last month for arresting Kashmir's human rights activist Khurram Parvez under its anti-terror law. India has dismissed the UN charges as baseless, but people and analysts say repressive techniques are being used to suppress dissent in Kashmir. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
As the seventh round of talks aimed at reviving the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA continue in Vienna, Iran's lead negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani says some of the issues raised by his team have been accepted, while others have not.
In the course of the talks that have taken place over the past few days, some of these issues were accepted by the other side and some were not. Therefore, we will have a number of issues alongside previous areas of disagreement, which are not too many, that will form the basis for serious discussions at the level of senior negotiators from Iran and the 4+1 countries.
The new Iranian team says it's asking for the verifiable removal of all post-2015 U.S. sanctions before it goes back to full compliance with the JCPOA. Iran has also asked for guarantees the U.S. would not withdraw from the deal again or impose new sanctions that would impede its implementation.
We have a basic logical red line, an agreement that was finalized in 2015 between Iran and the P5 plus 1. The US withdrew from that deal and now it wants to re-enter. So this agreement is a common basis between the two sides. Therefore, we will definitely not accept anything less than the JCPOA. This will definitely be a red line for Iran.
Meanwhile, European officials warn that time is running out amid claims that Iran's demands are stalling progress.
The Europeans know quite well that issues that are unresolved in the previous draft or issues within the previous draft that were in violation of the JCPOA, they will have to be fixed and they will have to be corrected. They understand this. And while the Europeans are speaking about the original draft, but they know quite well where things stand.
According to an EU official, talks are advancing logically, while the Russian delegate has pointed out that certain misunderstandings from the previous week have now been resolved, although reaching a final deal will take time and a lot of effort. Homolesky, Vienna.
On Friday, a string of large and smaller school unions held a general strike against the 2022 government's budget law. Unionists complained the law, which is expected to be approved by the end of this year, fails to allocate funds for reasonable adjustments and pay protection for teachers, undermining, quote, for the umpteenth time, the importance of education. Teachers and pupils took to the streets of several Italian cities, including Rome, Milan, Bologna, and Torino, calling on the Mario Draghi-led executive to review the planned budget and finally bring investments into public schools up to EU standards.
L'Italia investe.
Funds destined for the COVID-19 response are higher than those for repairing and maintaining our school buildings. The problem is that school managers don't know how to spend the COVID funds, and the money goes unspent.
Italy invests in education 1 percentage point of GDP less than the European average, which translates into about 17 billion euros, a huge amount of money.
According to union leaders, teachers' national collective contract cannot be renewed if the budget bill remains unvaried. Salary levels have remained much lower than the EU average, and a growing percentage of teachers, about 15%, works under temporary employment.
The government is proposing a 12 euro monthly pay rise in the next collective contract, less than peanuts. They say we should work for the greater good rather than for the money.
With energy costs, pressures continuing to drive consumer price inflation, the cost of living in Italy is on the rise. Italy's annual inflation rate rose to almost 4% in November, the highest level since September 2008.
Italy also plans to set aside about 8 billion euros for tax cuts in its 2022 budget law. Some trade unions say the move will benefit especially the upper middle class rather than low-income households. For this reason, two large trade unions, CGL and WIL, will stage a general strike on December 16. Max Civili, Rome.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets of the Gaza Strip to mark the 34th anniversary of Hamas establishment. Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, also held a military parade, while other participants waved Hamas flags, chanting slogans in support of the resistance group.
We will keep fighting against the Israeli crimes. We will sacrifice our lives. We will keep defending our rights, and we won't remain silent. There will come a day when we all pray in Al-Aqsa Mosque and liberate our lands.
Addressing the rally, senior Hamas official Mahmoud Al-Zahar said celebrating the movement's establishment indicates that Hamas was founded to unite the Palestinian people and lead them in their struggle against Israeli atrocities.
The
Palestinian resistance continues in all parts of Palestine, including the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, as long as the Israeli regime violates our rights and grabs our lands. The resistance will respond to all Israeli attacks. We praise our forces for their last battle against the Israeli attacks in Al-Aqsa and their land grab in Sheikh Jarrah. We will always remain committed to our duties of defending Palestine.
Founded in 1987, Hamas is the largest Palestinian resistance movement. Since 2007, it has ruled the besieged Gaza Strip and has since defended the impoverished enclave against four major Israeli wars, including the most recent 11-day conflict that ended in an Egyptian rocket ceasefire in May.
Hamas renewed its promise to liberate our land and defend our people as our struggle against this occupation persists. Palestinian resistance is our shield against this Israeli regime and its violations and crimes against us, and we are certain it won't disappoint us.
People hail the Palestinian resistance for defending their rights and fighting against the Israeli aggression, especially amid the recent wave of normalizing of ties with Israel. Palestinians say they will continue their resistance until the rights of the nation are restored. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Another moment of pride for Iran at the United Nations for its active partnership since joining the world body in 1950. The country has now become a full member of the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. Iran's accession was approved by a unanimous vote at the Special Political Committee of the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. UNSCEAR rarely expanded to include new members, but under the resolution proposed by Australia, four countries were admitted, raising the number to 31. Norway, Algeria, and the UAE were other nations who joined the body. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht Ravanchi, praised the General Assembly's decision to admit Iran into the committee. He expressed Tehran's full support for the body in its scientific endeavors to protect the planet and humans.
Iran reiterates its full support for and cooperation with the UNSCEAR in order to further enhance the infrastructure capacity and training of its personnel, as well as support nuclear safety, protect the public health and the environment from the harmful effects of atomic radiation.
Iran's accession is perceived as a major step forward since the top UN scientific body on nuclear safety has always been under Western influence. As expected, the decision faced stiff opposition from Israel and the U.S. Takht Ravanchi responded to anti-Iran allegations raised by Israel and the U.S. He said the track record of Tel Aviv and Washington show they are not in a position to oppose Iran's membership to the scientific committee. The Iranian envoy said that while the Israeli regime has flagrantly violated many U.N. resolutions and defied international efforts to contain weapons of mass destruction, Washington dishonored its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal. A nuclear scientist has hailed Iran's accession to the committee as a very positive step.
In general, it's a good move for Iran. Iran can have send some of its scientists to the mission to join the work and the effort of this committee. I think at the end it will be a very positive step for Iran.
The Vienna-based body was set up by a UN General Assembly resolution in 1955 and is affiliated with the UN Environment Program. The committee is tasked with providing information on nuclear radiation and its associated health risks and hazards. The committee's work has served as a basis for evaluating the risk of nuclear exposure and establishing best practices and protective measures.
Shock and anger was expressed outside the Royal Court of Justice in London Friday as the court ruled that jailed journalist Julian Assange can be extradited to the US to face espionage charges. The decision overturned a previous ruling that the WikiLeaks founder could not be forcefully shipped to the US due to mental health concerns.
Of course, we are slightly disappointed
It is very, very difficult to get a fair hearing from a justice system in the United Kingdom in anything which cuts across the perceived interest of the security state, be it the UK or the United States. But this is a stage in the struggle, and the legal battle and the political battle will continue.
Assange, 50, is wanted in the US on allegations of conspiracy to obtain and disclose national defense information after WikiLeaks famously posted thousands of leaked documents, spilling the beans on Western crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. His supporters, however, believe he is a true journalist whose only crime is exposing corruption and war criminals.
I had mixed emotions. I thought that he would be clear today, to be honest. Because, let's face it, all Julian has done is released crimes, not secrets. He's revealed crimes. And when someone reveals crimes, you expect the criminals to be in prison, not the man that reveals the crimes.
Fighting back the tears, Assange's fiancée, Stella Morris, said the decision will be appealed, describing the ruling as an affront to press freedom and democracy.
Julian exposed the crimes of CIA torturers, of CIA killers, and now we know that those CIA killers were planning to kill him too. How can these courts accept an extradition to the country that plotted to kill Julian, that plotted to kill a publisher because of what he published? This goes to the fundamentals of press freedom and of democracy.
Family and supporters of Assange have expressed deep disappointment and anger at today's verdict. However, his legal team have advised us that the fight is far from over, so this won't be the last time that we're out here outside the Court of Justice. Robert Carter, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on his people to be patient and trust his government's new economic plan. In remarks after his cabinet meeting, Erdogan said price increases in Turkey were being caused by greed and importer prices. The president also called on Turkish people who own foreign currencies to take advantage of what he called his new economic model's opportunities.
Turkey is the breakout star of the global economic system that is being restructured with the pandemic. We should completely mobilize our country's potential to this end. No one should ever forget that every penny spent on investment and production is a brick laid for the construction of the future of the great and powerful Turkey.
The plan that President Erdogan was trying to convince Turkish people to put their trust in is considered by analysts as a risk, as its results are not only imperative, but also needs time.
The government wants to bring in more foreign currency by increasing the export and, of course, with the low lira value that might encourage investors. The government is trying to attract foreign investments, thinking that this would help increase income and decrease inflation. And to encourage investors, they are lowering the interest rates. This is a risky policy, however, it can be successful. But the result of such a plan will not show now, and it will leave the current country in a bad economic situation for another few years. I'm not sure the people will support the government until then.
Turkey's lira weakened as much as 2.6% to 13.8070 against the US dollar before Erdogan spoke. Lira has lost 46% of its value to the US currency this year. Many here believe that the promises by the president may not be based on solid ground, especially that the plan is considered by economists to be risky. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Cinema Verite is the title of the only documentary film festival in Iran. The annual event is a once-in-a-year chance for documentary filmmakers from Iran and the world to get together and get their works evaluated by the festival's jury. It's the first time the annual event is held physically after the coronavirus pandemic forced the organizers to hold it online.
Last year, the event was held with no physical participation and all of the films were screened online. This year, we considered two ways, online and physical screening. And the participation was beyond our expectations. Filmmakers from Japan, South America, Germany, and France have sent their works to the festival.
551 films were submitted to the Cinema Verite Secretariat, out of which 179 works were selected and put to the contest. There's no limit for the themes. They can cover the sufferings of war-ravaged nations or deal with the socioeconomic impacts of the coronavirus. But there's one general yardstick. They need to present an unbiased portrayal of the truth.
There are four main sections of full-length, mid-length, and short documentaries, as well as the special jury prize for international works.
The competing films will be screened both online and in theaters in Iran for a week, and the best works will be honored in the closing ceremony, slated for December 16th. Through the course of the cinematic event, renowned documentarians from Iran and the world will be attending the festival to hold workshops.
Fiction films aim to entertain the audience with the imaginations of a filmmaker. But when it comes to documentaries, filmmakers must avoid the imagination factor, yet inspire people merely with realities. Realities that sometimes are ordinary, but need a second but different look. And that's what makes the competition tough in the week-long course of Cinema Verite. Yusuf Jolib, Tehran.
Demonstrations are a staple of the British democracy. A peaceful protest rally last month against the Israeli ambassador, Tzipi Hotovli, leaving a debate at the London School of Economics. The event passed off peacefully. Police made no arrests. But then came a torrent of criticism from British officials and anti-Semitism allegations from pro-Israel organizations, chiefly from the Community Security Trust, CST, a charity with the purported mission of looking after the Jewish community in the UK. Campaigners say the CST misrepresented the event as violent and linked the protesters to terrorism.
And now pro-Palestine campaigners are fighting back. They have called on the UK's charities regulator, Charity Commission, for an urgent investigation into the Community Security Trust for engaging in political activity.
There is a definition on what a charity is and what a charity should do. And, you know, to go around and receive huge amount of money, not just from the, you know, ordinary individuals, but from the British government. I mean, British government actually gives CST huge amount of money, and they are almost embedded within the Metropolitan Police, could really damage those who are supporters of Palestine because they're well-placed and well-respected. That cannot go on.
The letter accuses the organization of routinely attacking those who organize or take part in campaigning for the rights of the Palestinians with tactics such as character assassination and false accusations, all aimed at shielding Israel from criticism.
What they are doing in the pursuit of defending undefensible, they actually begin to attack and demonize those who support Palestinian cause. And, you know, they do it to the Muslims who are doing that, non-Muslims, even those from the Jewish community that honorably is standing and defending the right of the Palestinians.
The pro-Palestine campaigners have also criticized the preferential treatment the Community Security Trust and other pro-Israel organizations receive in the UK, while their Muslim counterparts are frequently demonized. They say the ball is now in the charity regulator's court to hold the CSD to account or throw its own integrity into question. Saeed Purza, London.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis and elaboration on the thoughts and speeches of the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Ali and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, brother. And Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Very welcome again to the program, Viewpoints on the Speeches and the Important Points addressed by the leader of Iran and the leader Muslim of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Today we want to talk about an important topic. Here and there on different speeches, the leader of Iran addressed about the comprehensiveness of the religion of Islam, that Islam is a religion which can be useful for both the other world and this world. So it covers most of the dimensions and the aspects of the practical life of all the people around the world. I think the most important change that Islam wants us human beings is the value that you